It's the NPR News Update for Monday, July 21st. Good day, I'm Phil Picardi. Today on the podcast, GOP gubernatorial candidates steer clear of social issues. The state gears up for medical marijuana. Minnesota connections to the shutdown airliner. Healthcare reform in schools and more on clergy abuse. First, hot weather today in the Twin Cities and in parts of central and western Minnesota. Heat indices could reach triple digits. That's ahead of strong storms expected across the region tonight. Cooler than normal temperatures so far this summer have helped reduce the threat of West Nile virus. Mark Stile reports.
State Health Department epidemiologist Dave Neitzel says hot summers generally produce the most cases of the mosquito-borne virus. Neitzel says so far this summer has been relatively quiet.
We are investigating a couple of suspect cases, but nothing confirmed yet.
Although most infected people will not get sick, about 20% suffer symptoms like headaches and vomiting. In rare cases, the virus causes inflammation of the brain. Neitzel says anyone who's outdoors, especially at dusk and dawn, should use mosquito repellent. Mark Stile, Minnesota Public Radio News, Worthington.
All the rain that has fallen this summer is helping Minnesotans save on water bills. Here's Martin Moylan.
Water utilities in both St. Paul and Minneapolis say they're not seeing a typical summer surge in water use in the two cities and adjacent suburbs. Jim Krautman is Production Division Manager for St. Paul Regional Water Services. He says water use this month has been down about 10%.
Last July, we averaged 55.3 million gallons a day for the month of July. And like I say, we've only had one day over 50. And I was just barely over 50 this year.
Minneapolis says water use was about 8% below expectations in June. Last month was the wettest June in history for many Minnesota communities. An average of nearly 8 inches fell across the state. Martin Moylan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Former Vikings punter Chris Cluey is expected to file a lawsuit against the team this week. That after he met with the Vikings about the findings of an investigation into allegations of anti-gay remarks by a Vikings coach. Dan Gunderson reports.
The Vikings released a summary of a 6-month investigation Friday, which says coach Mike Prefer made one anti-gay comment to Cluey. The Vikings suspended Prefer for 3 games without pay. The suspension will be reduced to 2 games if he completes sensitivity training. Cluey's attorney, Clayton Hollinen, says the Vikings reneged on a promise to release the full investigation report.
We think we know why. I mean, I think it's quite obvious. There's some very troubling information in the report. There's embarrassing information in the report about how the Vikings acted with the information and how they failed to take action.
Cluey contends the Vikings released him because of his advocacy on GLBT issues. The Vikings say he was let go because of poor performance. Dan Gunderson, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The 4 Republicans running for governor in next month's primary are not saying much about a topic important to many Republican voters, social issues. Even as Scott Honor, Jeff Johnson, Marty Seifert, and Kurt Zellers tout their conservative credentials on the campaign trail, they're largely steering clear of topics like same-sex marriage and abortion. Tim Pugmire has more.
All 4 GOP candidates oppose abortion. They gave identical answers to the survey questions posed by the group Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life for its primary voters guide, including a pledge to support legislation to limit and or prohibit taxpayer-funded abortions. Hennepin County Commissioner Jeff Johnson, the Republican-endorsed candidate, said he would sign legislation that fits his views on abortion if it reaches his desk. But he said he won't be advancing that at all if he's elected. Johnson said he also supports traditional marriage between a man and a woman, but has no interest in trying to repeal the same-sex marriage law enacted in 2013.
I think most of us are past that. I think most Minnesotans would prefer not to raise that issue again and move on to things that they see as more relevant in their lives, and that's where I am. If a bill were to come to my desk, I would sign it, but I'm not going to expend any energy at all pushing for that because that's not why I'm running for governor.
It's a similar story with Johnson's primary rivals. Businessman Scott Honor said he's not bringing up social issues, and the Republicans he's been talking to aren't either.
The only time it comes up is when reporters ask about it. Right? So, you know, what we're talking about is how we're looking forward at what the right priorities should be for the state. And, you know, and that's what my message has been very clear about.
One reason the candidates aren't talking about divisive emotional issues may be because they've been burned by them in the past. Republicans tried to ban same-sex marriage with a constitutional amendment on the ballot in 2012. But voters rejected the measure, and the GOP lost majorities in the Minnesota House and Senate. Former House Speaker Kurt Zeller said he doesn't blame one loss on the other. He believes there were multiple factors. But Zeller said he also believes the marriage debate is over.
I think people on both sides of the aisle used it for political purposes, for fundraising purposes, but it's a done issue. I'm not talking about it anymore. The voters spoke, you know, and quite honestly, letting the people vote on it instead of the politicians play games with it, I think is actually better because now we know where Minnesotans are.
That's not what some conservatives want to hear. Autumn Leva, Director of Legislative Affairs and Communications for the Minnesota Family Council, said she doesn't know why the candidates are avoiding social issues, but Leva said conservative voters are noticing.
From what we've heard from folks around the state that share our values, there is some concern because I think the conservative base is looking for a leader who not only shares their values, but will also work to protect their values and religious freedoms and things like that at the governmental level.
A Republican could be elected governor this year and the House majority could swing back to the GOP, but the Minnesota Senate isn't up for re-election this year and will remain in DFL control for at least two more years. Former State Representative Marty Seifert said that political reality is why he's not talking about a repeal of the same-sex marriage law or any of the other DFL passed laws he disagrees with.
It's my job as governor of the state to faithfully execute the laws that we have. The laws that we have are things like medical marijuana, gay marriage, the highest minimum wage in the United States. And you may or may not disagree with that as a citizen or a policymaker, but be realistic that the stuff isn't getting repealed and it's a waste of time to be arguing about it anymore.
But the candidates are talking about other issues that would be hard to get past a DFL-controlled Senate, including big changes to MNsure, more tax cuts, and deep spending cuts.
Tim Pugmire on the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. Minnesota is gearing up to get into the medical marijuana business. The state's health department is expected to name a director of its medical cannabis agency this week, and a new advisory panel will meet in 10 days. Tim Nelson reports.
Sarah Wellington is a 40-year-old mom and an English teacher at a St. Paul middle school. She's also going to be one of the key people guiding Minnesota policy on medical marijuana.
I've had MS for almost 4 years, and I think this is one area that hasn't been explored completely for people with MS.
This spring, the National Multiple Sclerosis Society asked her to apply to join the state-mandated 23-member Task Force on Medical Cannabis Therapeutic Research. They are a group of legislators, healthcare experts, law enforcement officials, and drug abuse experts, and they include potential users of state-sanctioned marijuana, people with cancer, epilepsy, Crohn's, and other diseases.
I would say I'm a prospective consumer. The things I've read in alternative medicine, the talks I've had with other patients who have MS, I do think that MS is one of the ones that would be supported through the use of marijuana.
It'll probably be almost a year before Wellington or any other Minnesotan can fill an order for medical marijuana. The legislature approved pills and oil this spring. Right now, the state's health department is ramping up its Office of Medical Cannabis, the regulatory group that will oversee medical marijuana production and use. There are three main projects looming ahead for the state. First, officials have to determine if there's an existing source for the medical marijuana Minnesota is expected to need. The law passed by the legislature this spring calls for the state to determine if the federal government can supply it. There's an August 1st deadline for that decision.
There is a farm licensed by the National Institute of Drug Abuse in Oxford, Mississippi, at the University of Mississippi, that grows the only federally sanctioned cannabis.
That's Manny Munson-Regala, an assistant commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Health, who's setting up the Office of Medical Cannabis. He says he doesn't think the state will qualify for the federal supply because it's meant mostly for clinical research, which Minnesota isn't doing.
Not to mention that they already have commitment to supply other folks. The other part is they only supply raw leaf. As you know, under the Minnesota law, raw leaf is not acceptable.
That probably means that Minnesota will have to grow its own. State law allows for two producers to grow, process, and provide the drug to registered users in a limit of 8 locations. The health department is thinking of giving each company a mandate to locate distribution centers in either odd or even-numbered congressional districts to assure geographic diversity. Preliminary regulations are expected to be released August 1st, and manufacturers could start operations as soon as December. Sale of their products is to start July 1st of 2015. The second task for the state is to set up the agency to solicit and regulate that business. Health officials expect to have about 10 people working in the Office of Medical Cannabis inside the health department. Munson Regala says he may name a director as soon as this week. A research director, operations manager, and policy expert will be brought on board after that. Finally, the new law sets up that 23-member board, which will convene for the first time on July 31st and watch over the establishment of the Office of Medical Cannabis. Again, Manny Munson Regala.
The thought would be that they're going to provide direction to the legislature informed by the experience of implementing the OMC to help the legislator think about broader policy implications, additional conditions, additional methods of ingestion, potential, I suspect, conversations around public consumption.
They're supposed to give a complete picture of the patient registration system to the legislature in February, and reports on the impact of medical marijuana starting in 2017.
Tim Nelson for us. Some Minnesota school districts say they're finding requirements of the Affordable Care Act especially challenging. Schools are among employers that will have to add employees to their insurance plans next year. School officials say the health care law's requirements are especially confusing for an industry where substitute teachers, coaches, and a host of other part-time employees work variable hours. Catherine Richard has more.
Next year, some of Minnesota's schools, teaching assistants, counselors, and nutrition workers will be offered insurance for the first time. Employers, including school districts with more than 50 employees, have to extend benefits to anyone working 30 hours a week, or they may face hefty fines. School officials say the so-called employer mandate is not as simple as it sounds. Most teachers already get benefits through their union contracts, but figuring out who meets that 30-hour-a-week threshold among newly eligible employees is difficult, with so many of them working 9 months out of the year. Employees who work part-time but who also coach sports are complicated cases, too. And then there's the problem of substitute teachers. Cook County School Superintendent Beth Schwartz says her subs work a wide range of hours.
You know, some of them just barely make that cut. Well, then how do you offer health insurance to some of your substitutes, but not all of your substitutes?
The Obama administration cited the complicated nature of the employer mandate when it decided to delay it until 2015 instead of having it kick in this year. The mandate is also controversial. Critics say it will force employers, particularly those in retail and in hospitality that hire many part-time workers, to trim hours or to stall hiring altogether. And if they don't do either of those things, critics say it will cost businesses a lot of money to provide insurance. That may be the case for the Montevideo Public School District. Superintendent Luther Heller is still crunching the numbers, but he says initial estimates show he will have to budget as much as $350,000 a year to cover the cost of offering health insurance to as many as 80 additional employees. That's a relatively small percentage of his district's $16 million annual operating budget.
But it's still a very sizable increase. We don't have an extra $300,000 that we're just not using for anything.
Heller isn't alone. According to Minnesota Management and Budget, Minnesota schools could end up spending about $200 million to cover more employees. But officials say the cost could be lower, in part because it's possible that fewer people will opt for insurance than are actually eligible for it. That's what the Austin Public School District is counting on. District Director of Finance and Operations Mark Stotz said newly eligible employees will be offered insurance, but they will have to pay for all of it. Stotz said he expects most of those employees are already getting coverage through a spouse or through a cheaper plan on their own. It's possible the school district will face a fine in this scenario, but Stotz said that in the long run, it will be cheaper to pay it than to cover more employees. Dan Weir is a consultant helping Minnesota schools navigate the requirements of the Affordable Care Act. He says there's another way the law is changing how schools handle health insurance. Many schools he's working with are considering shifting their low-wage workers and retirees to the state's new health insurance exchange, MinSure. If the employee's income is low enough and they qualify for a government subsidy to buy insurance on the exchange, MinSure may actually offer a better deal.
I mean, if they're low-income or part-time people, they get a much better plan and a much lower cost through MinSure than the district could ever even come close to. So it's sort of a win-win situation.
Even so, Weir said those changes would be subject to collective bargaining negotiations.
Catherine Richard on the NPR News Update. If you're applying for a job at a hospital, child care center, or home health agency, don't be surprised if you're asked for your fingerprints and a photograph. Matt Sepik has more.
Despite opposition from privacy advocates, state lawmakers and Governor Mark Dayton this year enacted legislation that overhauls Minnesota's criminal background check system for a variety of caregivers. The Department of Human Services is now starting to help employers prepare for the change. The department says the new system will be more efficient for workers, employers, and the state. If you have a common last name like Smith, Abdi, or Olson, and you're applying for a job as a nurse or childcare worker, there's a chance your legally required criminal look-back check could get hung up in a shuffle of paperwork. That's because the current system relies primarily on names and dates of birth to identify applicants. Minnesota Human Services Commissioner Lucinda Jessen says the new system will be a lot more efficient because it'll use fingerprints instead.
We're going to get more timely results, which is good for employees, good for employers, but mostly because they're more accurate, it's good for vulnerable children and adults all around our state.
Jessen says the state performs about 1,200 background studies every day, or more than 275,000 a year. She expects that number to drop by two-thirds with the new system because people won't have to undergo a full check each time they change jobs. Instead, she says employers can do a quick look at a database to see if an applicant has already been cleared. And Jerry Kerber, the Department of Human Services Inspector General, says the checks that are done will be more accurate. Now, if an employee at a nursing home is convicted of a crime making the worker ineligible for the job, DHS learns about it only if a corrections agent or probation officer tells the agency. Kerber says the new system will notify DHS automatically.
The background study that we do on somebody will remain current as we go forward. So it's not just a one-time background study. It's sort of the person is going to be in the background study system and will learn about any kind of new activity that the person is engaged in that may be significant in their role as a caregiver.
Kerber says the department will start training employers on the new system this summer, and fingerprint stations will open around the state between January and April of next year. He says a $3 million federal grant is covering the implementation costs, and the state will continue to charge a $20 fee per look-back. Daryl Shreve with Aging Services of Minnesota, a trade group for nursing homes and assisted living facilities, says he welcomes the new system.
As a previous provider of care, that will help me sleep better at night, knowing that there isn't something hidden going on with one of my current employees that were good last January but may not be good today. And without that knowledge, I may have someone working for me caring for people that I don't want caring for people.
The law implementing the new fingerprint-based system passed both the Minnesota House and Senate unanimously, but it's not without its critics. Teresa Nelson, the legal director at the American Civil Liberties Union of Minnesota, says a data breach could put the personal information of thousands of people into the hands of criminals. And while the measure prohibits the Department of Public Safety and the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension from retaining applicants' fingerprints, Nelson says that ban could go away.
It would be very easy in the future for the government to make changes to policy to allow this information to be widely available to law enforcement or to be retained much more widely. We've seen that with DNA collection. We've seen that with Social Security numbers.
Nelson says the ACLU has no plans to sue the state to block the measure, but she does say she'll be keeping a close eye on how the new fingerprint-based background check system is implemented.
Matt Sepik for us. A Wilmer man says his brother was among the victims of the Malaysian air flight apparently shot down over eastern Ukraine. Drew Ryder says his brother Arjen and sister-in-law Yvonne were returning from a vacation in the Netherlands to the family's home in Western Australia. Ryder says his parents were Dutch immigrants to Australia, and the family still has close ties to Europe. On Morning Edition, Kathy Werzer talked with Drew Ryder.
Tell me about your brother and your sister-in-law.
Well, my brother Arjen was just one of the most generous, loving people I've ever known, just a very warm person, and great to be around. He and I, whenever we saw each other, which typically was every year or so, we would just always pick up where we left off. His wife, Yvonne, was just a wonderful partner as well to him, and they were incredible parents, grandparents. They will be sorely missed.
I understand yours is a family of great faith. How is that faith helping you handle such an awful situation?
Well, it's very hard to explain, Kathy. You know, faith is very mysterious, and I got to say that I've just gone the last couple of days. I've had an unnatural calmness about me. I've been very public about my faith and about our family's faith. Our entire family are very strong Christians, and as part of that faith tradition, we see a divine plan in things. We often don't understand why things happen, but we also believe that there's a divine plan. And in this situation, we're all struggling to understand why it occurred. We feel very badly about you know, what happened, and we grieve with all the other relatives that lost loved ones. But we also believe that ultimately things happen for a reason, and that at this point we are comforted by the fact that both Arjen and Yvonne are in a better place.
Are you concerned about the chaos in Ukraine and the process of recovering the bodies?
You know, obviously we're not ignoring it, but it's not important to us. You know, we're not placing any blame here. If anything, we feel we want to forgive anyone that was involved in causing this, and that's part of our faith. I mean, we're not looking for retribution. If anything, we think that just will create even more violence. If anything, we want these lives that were lost to potentially contribute to a situation where we have peace rather than more conflict.
What else do you want listeners to know about your family and your brother and your sister-in-law?
Well, they were just they were from a community, a fairly small community, probably about twice the size of Wilmer, 30,000 people. Arjen was did some great things. He spent 30 years working for the Department of Agriculture. He was due to receive a special award the day after he returned, would have been today, for 30 years of service. Did some very great work in the area of salinity and managing land and soil in Australia, which has been quite a challenge there. Just very well known in the community, and they'll be very missed. Obviously, the family is really torn up right now, and it's going to be very difficult when I return there in a week or so, and I grieve with them.
Well, thank you. We appreciate your time this morning, and our sympathies go out to you and your family.
Thank you.
That's Drew Ryder and Kathy Werzer. Also this morning, Kathy talked with our reporter Madeline Barron. Madeline, on the point of our Twin Cities Catholic Diocese clergy abuse story. And Kathy and Madeline talked about new details appearing in that story today online.
What can readers find in today's report online?
What we've published today goes much deeper into the cover-up than anything we've aired or published to date. It takes you inside and introduces more characters and new documents. You can also watch videos of key figures in the scandal, including whistleblower Jennifer Hasselberger, listen to private recordings of meetings with Neinstedt and his priests, read documents that show how Neinstedt and his predecessors, Archbishop Harry Flynn, Archbishop John Roach, chose to protect priests who sexually abused children.
Of course, we're talking about Archbishop John Neinstedt, current Archbishop John Neinstedt. You know, a lot has happened, as you know, in the past week. Last Monday, We had the hour-long radio documentary that traced the cover-up of clergy sex abuse in the Twin Cities Archdiocese, which goes back decades. The next day, lawyers released a sworn statement by Jennifer Hasselberger detailing her experiences as one of Archbishop Neinstadt's top advisors. And then Friday, the New York Times was calling on the Pope to hold Archbishop Neinstadt accountable. Where are we right now with this scandal?
Neinstadt appears to be under more pressure than ever, more calls for his resignation. And as we've reported, this includes calls from some wealthy donors who haven't spoken out publicly in the past. Meanwhile, Neinstadt continues to be largely absent from the public arena. Several priests I've spoken with are frustrated that Neinstadt hasn't done more to minister to parishioners during this time of scandal. Many priests feel like they're out there alone trying to defend the archdiocese's actions to their parishioners. I did reach out to Neinstadt most recently about a week ago, and his spokesman told me that the archbishop was on vacation in Michigan and that he couldn't talk because of spotty cell phone reception where he's staying. However, we have been able to get a glimpse of how Neinstadt was handling the scandal. We've obtained private recordings of several meetings between Neinstadt and many of his priests from the fall and winter of 2013, and they really show the archbishop blaming the media for the crisis and defending himself from tough questions by his fellow priests. Here's a 30-second excerpt from a meeting in December. It starts off with Neinstadt assuring his priests that he stands with them in the scandal.
I am on your side, and it hurts me whenever we have to take steps against a priest, because I, like you, hold the priesthood in such esteem. But we're just living in this atmosphere now that it's I think in order to reestablish credibility, we have to be able to say we don't have anyone in ministry who is a danger to children or to vulnerable adults.
We've posted this clip and others on our website today because they provide insight into how the Archbishop has been talking about this crisis with colleagues in the church.
Has an Archbishop ever resigned under this kind of pressure?
Yes, but it's rare. The best example would be in Boston, where the Boston Globe in 2002 broke a series of major investigative reports that led Cardinal Bernard Law to submit his resignation to the Pope. But in the end, only Pope Francis can decide whether Archbishop Neinstadt stays or goes. And even if Neinstadt did submit his resignation, it would still be up to the Pope to decide whether to accept it.
And of course, this hearing is later this afternoon, and you'll be there.
Right.
All right, Madeline. Thanks much.
You're welcome.
Madeline Barron and Kathy Werzer. And that's all the Monday news on the NPR News Update. I'm Phil Picardi. I'll be back tomorrow with the Tuesday news.